Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City 88.7 FM with Frances Nesbitt and Mags Morrissey.
Hello and welcome to the Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City. I'm Frances Nesbitt and I'm joined by Mags Morrissey. We're live today, Friday, and the show is repeated on Mondays from 4 to 5. And we would love to hear from you during the show. So if you're able, drop us a text to 086-353-7782 or email kitchengarden@corkc.ie. Today on the show, a little later on, we're going to be talking to Councillor Malcolm Noonan from Kilkenny about invasive species and some other things that are going on in the city. We're also going to talk about a little bit on Nature Notes about, well, some timely birds. Cuckoo. Mags was talking about the cuckoo last week. We'll touch on the cuckoo again. And there's some plenty of jobs to be doing in the garden at this time of the year. It's also Farm Safety Week this week, so we might give that a little mention as well. But Mags, how are you?
Good.
How was your week? A busy food week?
Well, busy all sorts of week, actually. Today, though, the horse needed his feet done, so I had the farrier. And the weather, actually, is having an effect on horses' hooves because it's so dry. Just around the edges of his hooves are kind of cracked and gone a little bit brittle and stuff. And even underneath and stuff, it's much drier than normal. So I suppose the weather's had all sorts of effects on everybody, including the poor animal. But I was just thinking as I was standing there watching him and stuff, it's lovely watching somebody with a skill and a craft and has kind of seen it 100,000 times. But it's always nice to watch something like that, isn't it?
Not an easy job being a farrier. Not an easy job.
No.
I used to have a neighbour when I lived up in Tinnelinton near Conaghy who was a farrier, and knocks and bruises and bangs, and like, it's a risky enough job.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's incredible to see how they handle the horse, like the, you know, confidence that kind of comes with it and how compliant they can make even a horse that doesn't want to cooperate.
Yeah, this guy he cooperated enough today, actually, so
good.
Wasn't too bad. But
so he has his feet all done.
His feet are done. They look lovely, actually. He looks like a woman who's had a pedicure, really.
Right.
Nice and shiny.
There's some creatures that love this dry weather and the hard ground, and that's my goats. So they had
yes.
a very, very, very bad winter with the wet ground and struggling with their feet, and they get interdigital dermatitis and they get foot rot and they get scalds from the wet and the muck, and they just don't like it. But they are thriving at the moment with the hard ground. The nails are breaking by themselves and
they've got less work to do,
they've
do you?
Put on loads of weight. They're loving it. It's great.
Very good.
Yeah. Now, they're also letting themselves out through the fence so that they can eat the hedges because there's no grass about the place, but that's okay. It's less troublesome than the pig who's letting herself out under a fence, through electric, climbing gates. She's doing whatever the hell she wants to go visit the neighbours for whatever reason.
Are they chatting to her or something?
I don't know. I don't. But this is the worst escape pig I've ever had. So
I think
nothing.
Once they get it in them, that's you can kind of just forget it.
It seems like she doesn't like her sister. She doesn't like staying with the other pig. And she's almost twice as big as her now. She won't let her eat. So when I bring in the food, she trots back for the food. Won't let her poor little sister have any of it. And then takes off again. She loves hanging out with the calf. Her and the calf are great mates. Don't know why. But then when she gets a bit tired of the calf, she pops across the road to have a chat with their dog and their cat. Then I've seen her trot down the road. But then she always comes back. It's a bit
good.
Scary.
I think it's funny the way they have personalities, isn't it?
Each pig I've had is different. They all have their own personality, and this one just has more personality than is good for her. But anyway, she's enjoying
the sun. I have two of their same family and stuff, and they haven't budged for months. Like literally, haven't budged, which is very
unusual.
This
one should have gone to you. Clearly.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah. You normally have the wandering pig.
Normally, I've had pigs up and down roads and in and out of gardens, into the kitchen and all sorts of different places and that.
Yeah.
But not this time. So
no, I have the wandering one now.
Yeah. Well, maybe everyone needs a turn.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, Malcolm is joining us in the studio. Come on in, Malcolm. Sit down there quietly. Say nothing until we come to you. We're talking about food. So you were in the English Market, Mike.
Yes, I was in Cork. English Market, be a place close to my heart because I was in college down there, between Princes Street and Grand Parade in Cork. Described by Rick Stein as the best covered market in UK and Ireland.
Oh, very good.
So, and it's 230 years old.
They did it up recently, I think, did they?
Well, it was first built back in 1786. And do you know why it was called the English Market? Yes,
because full of English.
The Protestants, or the English as they were called at the time, were in charge of the city then. So, and they developed the market. And then when there was a change in kind of in government, in local government, I'm not sure what year that, in 1840, the Irish then decided to develop a new market called the Irish Market, about like half a mile away on Corn Market Street down that direction of town. But
kind of similar to here in Kilkenny, where we've Irish town and then you had like the merchant wealthy classes in the city.
But it's funny, the English market is the one that survived, actually. You know, so it had a big fire back in 1980 and gutted a lot of the Princes Street part of it. But the Cork Corporation, in fairness to them, decided to refurbish it, and they did a really good job. So they put in, they kind of, well, changed things around and stuff and gave it a slightly better layout. The fountain, you know, the beautiful fountain in the middle and stuff, that wasn't damaged in the fire, which was good. And they put the kind of the upstairs,
the gallery.
The gallery into it. So, and they actually got a big award for it from the International Society of Conservation, International Federation of Conservation Societies, awarded it a gold medal for its contribution to architectural heritage.
Very good. Well, I paid a visit to the English market a few years ago before Her Majesty the Queen came over to visit, and I thought it was a bit run down and a bit kind of tatty. And then I was down there last year after her visit, and I was amazed at how fresh the whole place looked. It had really been tidied up. And I was down there just a few weeks ago again. I had a lovely, lovely lunch in the cafe upstairs in the gallery.
The
absolutely
Farmgate.
Gorgeous Farmgate Cafe. Yeah, really, really nice. And I ordered a couple of oysters, actually, and the girl said, picked up the phone, rang the fishmonger downstairs, and he popped up with the half dozen oysters. I was kind of thinking a bit robbed, actually, because if I'd bought them off him downstairs, I could have had them on the street and it'd be a third of the price. Anyway, it's a lovely place.
Yeah, it is a lovely place, and there's a huge selection of stalls and food, and there's a really nice atmosphere. It's full of kind of tourists and Cork shoppers.
Yeah, it is a good mix. Yeah, we were there last year too, and with the kids, and it's fabulous. Yeah, it's amazing.
Is there anywhere in Kilkenny that we could turn into the likes of the English market?
Interestingly, there is. Well, we could have done it with the brewery site if we got our hands on it, but that's not really sort. But across from there is an interesting space in Irishtown behind the post office that is covered. It was the old stables, the horse stables the first minutes. I had a look at it a few years ago with the owners, and it could be certainly a smaller version of it, yeah.
Because I did read an article during the week, I meant to mention it on the show later, but the whole idea of the food court is really come of age. So street food is great, but an area where you can have several kind of street food vendors together in the same place, very, very popular all over Europe.
Yeah.
And then you add into that a few kind of like retailers of kind of these artisan foods, and you're away, now.
It's funny because I think, haven't O'Sullivan's Tap Room started a little market, Saturday market. And it's covered, and wouldn't have the same vintage ambiance to it, it has a potential in there. And given that, you know, the Evans's Home is going to be redeveloped, we're going to do a big piece of work on the Carnegie Library, there's a whole opportunity for, I hate to use the term quarter, but a whole new redevelopment of that part of John Street.
But over time, the focus of a city always moves around. You see it in Dublin, you see it in Kilkenny, you see it in every city all over the world, I'm sure. And you maybe don't notice at the time that it's happening, but after 10 or 20 years, you can look back and think, everything used to happen up in that part of town and now it's happening down here. So maybe we are moving up towards the train station a little bit now.
I think so.
Away from somewhere else. One thing I've always thought, I'm a blow-in to Kilkenny, so I've only been here for 20 years. In another 20 years, I'll still be a blow-in. But one of the things I've always thought is that we have so much good stuff here, from an architectural point of view, an arts point of view, a civic pride point of view. It's a bit of a pity that we seem to, on a municipal level, sit on the laurels a little bit, rather than kind of visit other places and just continuously make ourselves better. Because I know people who are involved in civic development in other towns in Ireland, and they are always looking at Kilkenny. They're looking at Kilkenny and trying to emulate what we do here. We don't seem to be kind of up in the ante that.
Yeah, I have to agree. And I you know, since I had a public event a few weeks ago just about the heritage aspects of the old town centre, and one thing that Westport has done well, Clonakilty has done well, is they've brought in town architect to actually bring it all together. We have a lot of different public realm elements in the town centre that don't marry. They're all different standards, different types, different street furniture, different finishes on the paving, how the city is used. There's no doubt, you're absolutely right, we should be visiting and looking at other European towns. There's networks of towns that are working together. We were involved in one about 6 or 7 years ago, an Urbact project which was looking at heritage towns, and you can really learn a lot from these type of the experiences of other places. You know, there'll be quite a bit of discussion now about pedestrianisation the next number of weeks, as we have two experimental pedestrianisations of High Street for the Arts Festival, and I'm encouraged by the fact that the council is going to start using it to have a look at the impact on retail on those two days, because, you know, ultimately I think we do have to start having that start. We need to have that conversation and move on and start looking at.
There are things that we can do which have a huge impact on the people who live in the city, like pedestrianisation. That's going to affect anybody who drives through the town or spends any time in the town. But there are things that can be done to improve the overall city that's invisible or easy on the kind of occupant of the town. And that might be, you know, just coming up with, using the architect example, coming up with somebody who has a pitch for Kilkenny and the way the city might develop. So, you know, it's a medieval city. We're part of Ireland's ancient East. We talk about the medieval mile, and yet we put up street signs that look like they're from the 21st century. Like, there's no kind of connected thinking there. We've lots and lots and lots of festivals, but how do they fit with the personality of the city? How are they presented in a kind of medieval kind of way? You know, we have a brand almost like Ireland Income when it comes to the food. We have a brand, and then we seem to go out of our way trying to develop another one. So I had a huge argument with somebody recently about Origin Green. You know the Board Bia Origin Green thing? Origin Green, you think you know what that means, right? You think it means Ireland is a green place to produce food. You should try Irish food because it's green and wholesome and maybe even organic. Some people might think organic when they hear that kind of stuff. No, that's not what Origin Green means. Origin Green means that you've met a whole load of these criteria about where you source the ingredients in your products. So McDonald's are a member of Origin Green. Does that fit with the whole, you know, brand that we've developed for Ireland as a great food producing country? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, and so we have this reputation as a medieval kind of city, and then maybe we do stuff that kind of just impinges on that a little.
Yeah, I have to agree. And it, you know, there's certainly things we do very well. I mean, I think the Arts Festival, any Arts Festival uses the architecture of the city quite well in terms of the events, and they've been thinking. I think Eugene has been really instrumental in thinking about using spaces creatively for events, but we're missing a huge amount of the story of the city in between, that's hidden behind the facades of buildings, Tudor houses on the scale, on a par with Roth House, that are hidden on High Street, on John Street, Parliament Street, and there is an opportunity to bring all that stuff to life.
Wouldn't it be nice to scrape off a bit of concrete on the front of some of these buildings?
Yes, absolutely, and that involves a lot of work with premises owners and a huge piece of work. But again, I think a lot of that stems back to having a town architect in place that would really work on finishes, developing a colour palette for the street. You know, that you're not getting all sorts of weird and wonderful colours above shop premises, and then you get a flow to the place. You know, we're losing vernacular features, timber sash windows, all sorts of stuff are being lost out of the conservation area of the city that we shouldn't be letting go.
I love having you in, Malcolm, because you never know where the conversation is going to go. You were supposed to be talking to us after the break about invasive species in the garden and in the the public realm. But we're supposed to be talking about food, Max. Sorry, we weren't supposed to be arguing there about, you know, the development of Kilkenny. We have people listening to the show who've never been to Kilkenny. They'll never hear the people that listen to it online. Anyway, so pesto. You brought in some pesto.
I brought pesto. I brought mackerel as well from the English market.
Oh, that's lovely.
And pesto, because, well, lots of us have gluts of herbs at the moment. You probably have Malcolm. So basil is one that you'll have lots of now. So this is a basil pesto, and parsley. I don't have loads of parsley yet, but I might in another little while. So I'm going to make a parsley and pumpkin seed pesto, which I'm just going to give the recipe for now. So if you want to have a piece of this.
Do you find that the hot weather has kind of encouraged a lot of the herbs to bolt off to seed?
Things have bolted. Like, I've never seen anything like it, actually. I was talking to a guy earlier today and just saying it's a weird, really weird time in the garden.
It's been a crazy year. I feel sorry for all of these people that I meet on Twitter, new gardeners who are getting into gardening, and like 2018 is their first experience of trying to grow veg, because good God, I can't think of a year that's been harder. Like, we went straight from winter to like African conditions.
But it was really hard to get things out, and then you had them out like a week or two, and suddenly the ground was like cracking. Mine looks like there's an earthquake gone up through the middle of the garden in loads of places and that.
Now, so, as you're passing around that pesto and knives and everything, be careful you're not banging on the counter there. All people like will hear is the banging.
It's okay.
This looks absolutely lovely. Touch of garlic in here, Margaret?
Just a little.
Touch of garlic, okay. Would you want to give us the recipe for this?
It's a really garlicky pesto.
Smells lovely.
It's garlic and cashew nuts.
Hold it up to the microphone there so people can see it. There you go. Excellent.
But I'm going to give you the recipe actually for the parsley and pumpkin seed. Everyone knows how to make basil. So that one is basil, garlic, olive oil, parmesan cheese and cashew nuts.
That is really tasty.
Yeah, it is good, isn't it?
God, you could eat loads of that. That's a nice bread as well.
That's a sourdough that I made this morning.
Very good.
That's yummy.
Very good. So you talk away now for a few minutes. Me and Malcolm will just have a slice of bread.
Well, I just opened this and you can have mackerel with it.
No. Save.
Okay. The pumpkins, so you need for the parsley and pumpkin seed, 75 grams of pumpkin seeds, one clove of garlic, a large bunch of parsley, I don't know, maybe 50 grams or so, 150 to 200 mils of rapeseed oil or extra virgin olive oil, 50 grams of parmesan, juice of a half a lemon and salt and pepper. So put the seeds and the garlic into the blender and just zap it until it's a little bit coarse. Then add in your parsley and then very slowly, when turned on low, add your olive oil until you have a nice thick paste. So you mightn't need the whole 200 mils, just keep an eye on it. Don't put the cheese into the blender, you just stir that in, grated cheese afterwards, a little bit of lemon juice and salt and pepper to taste.
Keep the blender nice and low though as well, because if it's going too fast everything goes all over the place, but as well as that it kind of mushes up the herbs.
Yeah, you want to keep it coarse, you don't want to overdo it and stuff. Yeah.
And it can get quite hot as well actually if you're
and then if you want, like, it'll stay fresh in the fridge for a couple of days, but if you keep a nice little thin layer of olive oil on top, it'll last for much longer.
Right, listen, we better take an ad break, and when we come back we'll finish off on that, and then we'll come back to it. We'll just take an ad break, we have to pay the bills somehow, and we'll be back to talk more about your pesto after this. Text us on 086 353 7782.
Kitchen Garden is sponsored by the Artisan Food Retailers of Kilkenny.
And you're welcome back to the Kitchen Garden. I'm Francis Nesbitt and I'm here with Mags Morrissey. We're live today, Friday, from 4 to 5. So please do send in any questions or comments you have by text to 086 353 7782 or you can email kitchengarden@ckc.ie. There's a couple of messages in by text, not very complimentary actually, a couple of people giving out to us for giving out about Kilkenny. Obviously fans of the city, they don't want us kind of bad-mouthing it, particularly if this is going out beyond city realms. But we're just making suggestions. It's not all bad. It's a beautiful city, lovely place to live, and I'm glad I live here. We're joined as well in the studio by Councillor Malcolm Noonan, Green Party spokesperson on...
At the moment, what is it? Rural Affairs, Community Affairs and Local Government.
Oh, very good. That's kind of appropriate, actually, as you're a councillor in the local government.
Yeah.
But we were talking to Mags about that delicious pesto which you made, Mags, and the other recipe, and you had more to talk about?
Well, there's another pesto you can make as well, parsley and walnuts. Mm. So just instead of using your seeds or pine nuts, which pine nuts are very expensive, use toasted walnuts. So throw them in the oven on a dry tray for like 10 minutes at 180 and roast them first and then put them in. And they would work really well with the parsley, actually. Mm. Not so much with basil, but I think perfect with parsley. So that's another nice one.
And they are much, much cheaper than the pine nuts. Pine nuts are crazy expensive.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. I've actually been using walnuts, toasted walnuts, quite a bit. They work well with courgettes, and we have a great glut of courgettes at the moment. So,
What do you do with them?
I've had a great variety of courgette type salads actually in the past little while. So, but one that I did the other night for somebody was just grill your courgettes first of all, tiny bit of olive oil on them, a little bit of salt and stuff, and then put them on a skillet pan for a couple of minutes each side. And then in the salad, I had leaves, whatever bits, whatever wasn't bolted out of the garden and stuff, leaves. Some peas from the garden, some cashel blue cheese, and then some toasted walnuts, red onion, and then kind of a mint. It was a mint and oregano and parsley dressing. And
just watch the microphone there, mate.
That was dinner.
Sounds
yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
Sounds lovely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And tomatoes, a few tomatoes, whatever you have like that and stuff. But the grilled courgettes kind of make it kind of quite a substantial kind of meal and stuff. So, and there's so many of them, everybody seems to have them at the moment. So.
It's one of the jobs to do in the garden this week is to stay on top of the courgettes and harvest your courgettes, because like you look at it today and you think it's too small, tomorrow it's a marrow.
Yeah, it's mad.
Although you'd wonder where they're getting the water from to do all of that swelling. Now, Malcolm, you're in to talk to us about invasive species.
Yeah.
Dubliners, is that what you're talking about? Dubliners coming into Kilkenny?
Well, I mean, they're one kind of invasive species. primarily plants. I mean, this time of the year, or up to recently, we would have spent quite a bit of time removing Himalayan balsam from the River Nore. There's been a project ongoing there for the last 3 to 4 years, led by Pat Boyd of Keep Kilkenny Beautiful, where we're trying to eliminate this plant from sections of the River Brega and the city section of the Nore, purely as an opportunity to assess the benefit to native flora by removing it. And so we've done good sections of the Brega. We've done the River Nore from Fennessy's Mill. People in the city would be familiar with Fennessy's Mill, back as far as the Ossory Bridge. So it's a very easy plant to pull, and it's quite a bit of fun doing it, because it's a very fibrous tuber type plant with a very shallow root. So if you get down to the base of it, you can just pluck the plant off the surface of the soil. Difficult again, a bit more challenging now in this weather because the ground is so dry. Mm. And we just stack it up on trees, or stack it up in piles and let leave it to die. There comes a time past, say, end of June, mid-July, when you can't pick it, because it has a beautiful pink flower, and when it goes to seeds, if you're walking along the riverbank, you see the seeds popping off it.
They're quite spectacular when they pop. They kind of
explode on
in a spirally type thing.
That's it. Yeah. So,
and hundreds of seeds in every...
Hundreds of seeds, yeah. So I suppose it's just one of many invasive species that end up in Ireland, because we're an island nation and we don't have great border. I know we're talking about border controls of Brexit, but we certainly haven't had great border controls with invasive species. You know, we've got ash dieback, we've got giant hogweed, we've got Japanese knotweed, we've got a lot of invasive bug species that are coming in and affecting trees, and it's going to have a huge impact, not just socially, but environmentally and economically on the country. And it's something that perhaps in the past, and even currently, we should have had much better controls. If you look at Australia, how they've, you couldn't bring a morsel of an organism into the country without...
But even Australia, with its very, very strict biosecurity controls, is suffering a little. And I wonder, in this globalised world of ours, where you can stop people bringing in plant species from the garden centre, which might cause a problem, when you've got millions of pallets... filled with products coming in from Southeast Asia.
Oh yeah, I mean,
it's the pallet themselves maybe bringing in diseases that could affect the wood.
Exactly, you could be bringing in prepackaged bananas with cellophane wrapping on them. They could have insects in them. It's virtually impossible to stop the scale of it because of the nature of global trade. At the same time, I do think that central government has a role to play in supporting the work that we're doing at a local level, trying to control just one particular species, and also there's some very valuable work done by the National Biodiversity Data Centre in mapping invasive species, and that was under the threat of closure last year. You know, this was a serious piece of work that needs to be done to protect our native flora and fauna, and yet the government hadn't the foresight to see that this was front-loaded with funding to ensure that it was able to do its work.
Not all of the species that are invasive are ones that we can see, though. So we you know, people would be familiar with the Himalayan balsam, and actually when it's in flower, the bees really love it.
Yeah,
I remember a few years ago I thought I'd discovered a new species of bee, this white bee, but it was actually just covered in pollen from the Himalayan balsam.
Yeah, and there's, you know, the jury's out on that one. Some beekeepers and bee people would think that you know, that it has a benefit, you know, but the problem is with it that it forms such a dense canopy, is that it just completely blocks out the light from,
and that's the real problem, isn't it?
Also, because it's a poor root system as well, it doesn't stabilise a bank.
Exactly.
So in the floods and everything, it'll still wash the bank away.
Exactly.
And then spread itself all over the place.
And it's when they supersede something that's already there and then kind of take over from it. So one of the other things that we're hearing about is a lot about the crayfish plague. So the American crayfish coming in, just like the squirrel, it's bigger than the native, it brought in with it a disease, it's displacing and infecting the one that's already here.
That's right, yeah.
It's having a big impact.
It's having a huge impact as well. And again, you know, do we have a strategy to deal with it? Is there, you know, finance in place to help? But it may be gone to a point where it's gone too late, you know.
Are we even monitoring it here in Kilkenny on the rivers?
Yeah, there is monitoring ongoing through the National Parks and Wildlife Service. But again, I would go back to the point that the National Biodiversity Data Centre needs to be fully resourced to be able to deal with the scale of it. You know, we're an island economy that's fully dependent on, hugely dependent on agriculture and horticulture for our economic well-being. And I think that, you know, a lot of these, as climate change has an impact too, there's a lot of more unintended consequences of species coming in and being able to thrive in a climate that previously...
And being able to overwinter where they might have died. I think we're kind of... We suffer here, although Ireland is an island, it's an island with two nations on it, and one of those nations has free exchange of goods and so on with mainland UK, if you can call it that. And a lot of these diseases and invasive species seem to become established in the UK first and then creep onto the island of Ireland, like from the northeast.
Yeah,
that's probably not accidental.
No, it's not. And you know, again, I mean, these are going, I suppose, more conversations are going to take place around the whole Brexit talks and what kind of a border we're going to have between Northern Ireland and the Republic. And but there's no doubt that it's costing the state dearly. And you know, with the ash dieback disease now, we're going to have a serious problem. I know there's quite a bit of work being done through Quilta locally. Mick Power has done some fantastic work purely from the hurley making perspective, yeah. and looking at being able to splice hurls, because we're going to lose a lot of our native genetic stock of ash. And one thing that they have found is that the ash keys of local provenance have the best opportunity of trying to fight this. But they're doing work to look at a future for ash in Ireland, and it's not just in the hurley making industry, but as a wood fuel and all of that. And
very quickly we become used to our surroundings. So at the moment we're used to hedgerows and big trees sporadically kind of spaced in those hedgerows. Most of those big trees that we're looking at are ash.
Yeah.
And Kilkenny uses an awful lot of ash for those hurleys and so on. If ash dieback kind of affects all of those trees, we'll be looking at a very, very different scenery before long.
We will, yeah. Our countryside is going to look radically different,
yeah.
Because there are big, spectacular trees on our landscape, and they're a part of our psyche, you know.
Yeah,
that's one thing about them. And, you know, even some of the consideration at GA level is to look back at the Wavin Hurleys again and start looking at composite alternatives.
Jeez, that'd be an awful shame if that came about. One of the other ones, I heard Prince Charles on Gardener's World talking about invasive species in the UK as well, and they were kind of looking at some of the micro species, so some of the fungus and diseases that are affecting trees. There's a really nasty one that's affecting oak at the moment, so it's kind of an oak dieback, which in the UK, you know, famous for its kind of big oak trees, and in its landscape, very, very scary.
It is. It's very serious. And so, again, I, you know, I'm not sure, you know, in terms of our own strategy, in terms of how we deal with that and resource. I go back to the issue of resourcing agencies to try and, you know, there's plenty of research that's required to try and either tackle the importation, but also to try and see if there's genetic stock out there that's able to become resistant over time to that. You know, that's a big problem.
A lot of people will remember the Dutch elm disease, which kind of hit in the 80s and wiped out an awful lot of big trees in the hedgerows then. And there are some trees which are resilient to the beetle, which caused that.
That's correct,
yeah. So it's nice to see those starting to come back again. I had a couple out at Crowan and I thought they were going to survive, but once they reach that kind of 4 metre height, that's where the beetle flies, and sadly they got them.
Yeah.
So I don't have the ones that are immune. Now, that's on a large landscape kind of level and on a kind of municipal level down at the rivers. In the garden, a lot of these kind of plants come in because they look attractive. Yeah. Or they've got a nice flower on them. And then, so we bring them in via the garden centre, and then they go mad.
That's right. I mean, that's where the balsam came from, and that's where the knotweed came from as well. Yeah. It was a beautiful, it's got quite a stunning plant in its own right. And a lot of them, particularly aquatic plants that end up in watercourses, they're causing huge problems with deoxygenation of lakes and watercourses. So people have to be very careful what's brought in. I know there's a plant passport that comes in with most plant species, but it's how they end up out being discarded in garden waste out into wild areas or public areas, that they end up doing hunt hole damage. You know, that's I know with the knotweed, you know, transporting topsoil from the horticultural sector and local authorities moving topsoil, you know, even morsels of the plant can cause absolute.
I was reading actually
chaos.
1 centimetre of stem can grow to down to 2 to 3 metres in depth and 7 metres in width of Japanese knotweed from like 1 centimetre. So you can imagine like a load of topsoil from somewhere.
And it can cause huge amounts of damage.
And it can actually, in the UK, your estate agents are obliged to tell a buyer that there's Japanese knotweed on the premises if it's there. And it can cause trouble for like foundations and everything as well.
That's right.
It'll have an impact on your insurance and stuff like that as well if it's been identified in the on the property.
At a local level, and I know other counties have done similarly, we've carried out in the last number of years an inventory of all the sites that have that we know that have Japanese knotweed. Obviously, we had the well-publicised incident with Talbot Tower before.
Delayed the opening of the tower.
Yeah, delayed the opening. So we've the knotweed is now cordoned off and has been treated behind a screen. But also places like the slate quarries, there's huge infestations of Japanese knotweed down the slate quarries. And again, you know, ramblers, walkers can bring it in on their footwear unwittingly onto other sites and transport it and move it across other areas. So what we're hoping to do over the next number of years is try and manage as many sites, monitor the sites and bring in eradication companies to remove it over a 4 or 5 year period.
Like, wouldn't it be good to kind of do this before the problem gets even bigger? You know, why do we tend to wait until it's almost late before we do
something?
It's
been in the country a long time. It's been in since late 1800s, I think, isn't it?
But at the moment, touch wood, I don't have it at Crowan. But one place I do like to visit is the slate quarries. It's absolutely stunning. If anybody's listening and they haven't been down to the slate quarries and see the lake and stuff down there, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous place. You go in, you walk around, you could bring home some seeds on the bottom of your shoe.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. And you know, I mean, I recall years ago spending time with Groundwork. They were an NGO that used to remove rhododendron from the sessile oak forest down in Killarney. And it was fantastic work, but it was work that needed to be done persistently and consistently. And there's been a big issue there in recent years with the National Parks and Wildlife Service, where there's been no clearing of rhododendron. They were using different eradication programs, and it's caused huge controversy. And now any of the work that Groundwork had done over that preceding 20 years is effectively undone now. And it's, you know, the native, one of the last remaining up there in Glenveagh are the last two remaining stands of native oak left in the country that are under serious threat now. Again, by inaction and by arguments over the type of management approach that
and where the money should come from and who's in charge.
Exactly, yeah. And of course, you know, we have plants that are not native to Ireland that have become part of our culture, such as fuchsia down in South Kerry as well, and Mumbrisia, different plants like that. You know, they're not native, but they've naturalised themselves and are not a threat in any real way to our native flora.
Now, there's a few things that people can kind of, few guidelines that I found on invasivespecies.ie or invasivespeciesireland.com. Sorry, invasivespeciesireland.com. It's a joint project between the Republic and Northern Ireland, and it monitors and makes people aware of some of the species that are out there, and it asks people to report sightings of them. Everything from the kind of scary looking Asian hornet, which is a nasty looking beast that we'd rather not kind of become established here because it's not very good for our bees. Carpet sea squirt, did you ever hear of that? That's one I hadn't heard of. It colonies overgrow and swamp other species underwater, obviously, and they cover fish spawning grounds and they can destroy aquaculture cages and things like that. The koipu, which I've heard in on mainland Europe, has become kind of well established. The koipu is that it's like a rat. It's from South America, very, very large. They're actually in parts of Italy now. They're trying to encourage people to shoot and eat it. It's become so abundant. So it's larger than a cat, and they're afraid that it might kind of make its way here. The Pacific, or the pink humpback salmon, another one which presumably came in from aquaculture and which is now becoming established in the waters. So there's a whole load there. Right. But they give some guidelines, and they say that if you're moving from one watercourse to another as part of your leisure, bringing a boat or doing any fishing, that you clean and dry all of the equipment in between the places where you might bring the boat or whatever. And that makes sense. So you're not bringing around some of the water species with you. In terms of bringing in your bringing in pets, don't import any animal from mainland Europe where it might bring a pest in with it. Follow the guidelines in the bee plant wise section on the website, and they talk about non-native garden plants there, and particularly pond plants. So there's guidelines on that invasive species Ireland.com. I'd recommend people have a look at that. Malcolm, friend of the show, thanks a million. It was great to have you back in with us again.
And that was lovely pesto.
It was lovely pesto. Best of luck with the continued work flying the flag and doing the right thing on the council. And we'll take an ad break and we'll be back just after these.
You can email the show, kitchengarden@corkc.ie.
Kitchen Garden is sponsored by the Artisan Food Retailers of Kilkenny.
And you're welcome back to the Kitchen Garden. I'm Francis Nesbitt and I'm here with Mags Morrissey, and we're live here every Friday from 4 to 5, and this show is repeated on Mondays from 4 to 5 too. And while we're live, you can get in touch with us by sending a text to 086-353-7782, or you can email the show at any stage during the week, kitchengarden@corkc.ie. Scary kind of stuff, really, when you start talking about the invasive species, isn't it?
Yeah, it is kind of frightening, actually. And if you think of, you know, even pets that people bring in now, especially if our weather or our climate is going to change a little bit, like snakes, for one thing. People have snakes if they get out, you know, when things do change. So, yeah, it is scary, actually.
And some parts of the world have been so badly affected by it. Like, you look at the Everglades now, and there's some Asian species swimming around in the water there. Australia is probably the best example. Like, half of their wild mammal species almost wiped out because of invasive things like rabbits and cats and rats, you know. Let's just, you know, be diligent where we can, or like keep our eyes open where we can and report.
And not
any.
Throw plants kind of into the
over the hedge. Hedge.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, That's where a lot of wood was started.
So. Speaking of hedges, you wanted to talk in Nature Notes this week about a couple of birds, but a reminder to listeners that hedge cutting shouldn't be happening at the moment.
Well, they're hardly growing anyway, so why anyone would be cutting them? But it shouldn't be happening. And it's illegal. It's like against the law. I'm not sure when exactly that date is changing. I know it's gone to be signed by the president, but I'm not sure when it's changing. So at the moment, it's until the end of August. You can't
till the end
hedges.
Of August. You shouldn't, unless it's causing a hindrance or a hazard along roadways.
And that's really only, you know, kind of, you see tall grasses, which we don't really have anymore. They're absolutely burnt. So
or hedges leaning out over the road.
Yeah.
But if a farmer's driving down his field and cutting a hedge between two fields way away from the road, that's against the law.
That's against the law, yeah.
And there are birds still nesting. And I put up a video on Twitter during the week at NesbitF of a just such a case. A farmer had flail hedged as I was out walking the dog. I came across a nest fully exposed out in the open, and there were three or four little blackbird chicks in it.
Oh, okay.
Now, they didn't stand a chance.
No.
They're now exposed.
No.
If Mammy and Daddy hadn't actually been killed by the hedge trimmer, they were going to lose the battle of defending those chicks against magpies. And nothing to be done, because if you move the nest, Mammy and Daddy won't go near it. You can't feed the chicks yourself. It's a full-time job for two birds. You don't know what they're going to be eating, and you can't regurgitate it for them, you know. No. So that's the end of those. That's the end of those birds. And that was just one nest in a small little stretch that I passed. Thousands of it could be happening.
And because of our late spring, or, you know, straight into summer and stuff, nesting probably was a little bit later this year. So there's still, and some species either kind of nest late generally, or will have a second brood. And the yellowhammer, actually, you don't often see yellowhammers, but I saw one the other night, the other evening, on just down the road, actually. And they're one bird that do actually, which, and they're under threat, but they often nest into August.
There is a reason why these birds become so seldom, and become under threat, and become so rare, like the cuckoo that I know you want to talk about, and the yellowhammer. And it's because we do these things. It's no good to say only this year will I drive the tractor down because the winter was so wet, and when else will I get a chance for cutting the hedge? If you do it, don't be surprised in a year or two if those species aren't around anymore.
Yep.
they don't have very long lifespans. It's not like you're interrupting something once in a 20-year lifespan. These birds generally only live 1 or 2 years,
and they need
to produce the following generation.
They do. You know?
So the yellowhammer, an absolutely beautiful
bird.
Very, very striking. I love those stripes on the head. Really, really exotic looking, almost like a
it does
canary.
Look something from a pet shop almost. Yes, yeah, and
really
like
lovely.
I have to say, you could not but smile when you see it. So
a jolly, jolly bird.
Yeah. And they're under threat. They're struggling a little bit. And I hadn't seen one for quite a while, actually. But another bird that would have always heard is the cuckoo, but I haven't heard one yet this year. Now maybe, and I've been out so much, weather's been so nice, but I haven't heard one. But it's a widespread summer visitor. Interestingly, though, the mature birds, the adult birds, leave and go back to Africa in July, and the immature wait. I didn't actually realise that until recently, and don't leave until kind of August, September time.
The cuckoo amazes me, because just that, when the young grow up in a nest of another bird, so you're the cuckoo, you're growing up in a blackbird's nest, you fire out the blackbird chicks, poor mammy blackbird continues to raise you, or even a little tiny wren, you then become fully grown. How do you know to get to Africa?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Like, how does that happen?
They've just got built-in GPS and
it's
all the rest
incredible.
And stuff.
It's not like they hang around and then mammy comes back and says, "Are you right? Come on, we're off to Africa." You know?
No, I assume they don't, actually. Yeah, they get a foster parent. But when the female cuckoo goes to lay an egg in another nest, you know what it does to the eggs that are already there, if there's eggs in there? Takes it and eats it.
Yeah.
That is just awful, isn't it?
Yeah, they're not very nice.
No, they're not really, actually.
No. They do sound lovely.
They
but
do.
When
just
you think
the
of their nesting practices, it's not very nice.
And I've seen videos of them removing eggs from another nest, and it's like absolutely systematic and belligerent.
Yeah.
The others don't stand a chance.
No. And I've seen a video of that, like two wrens were carrying food to a cuckoo chick. The cuckoo chick was 10 times the size of the wren.
Yeah.
Like, these poor little birds were killing themselves trying to raise this chick that
now
they
you
thought
would wonder
theirs.
How they don't kind of go,
I know.
He
I
doesn't
know.
Look like you.
Yeah, he doesn't look like me either.
Yeah.
It is funny.
But their diet is mostly caterpillars and insects.
Which is good for the gardener.
Yeah, and apparently you can confuse them with sparrowhawks when they're in flight because of the colour and the shape of the body and the wings and that. But they do a little bit more flapping than the sparrowhawk would be, a bit more of a glider.
And would there have been many of them in Kilkenny, generally?
Yeah. Well, Kilkenny wouldn't be the best place for them. Mm. If you really, like, absolutely want to hear them, the Burren and a couple of places in the west are better for them, actually.
I wonder why that is now. Is there a species over there that they prefer to kind of, like, nick the nests of, or...?
Well, there'd be huge, like, kind of big expanses of undisturbed, really, land, I suppose, would be maybe one reason. They tend to, like, kind of farmland, edge of woods, or kind of coastal areas. You find them in sand dunes a bit and that.
Okay.
I'm disappointed I haven't heard one yet this year. It's unlikely now, really, I suppose, at this stage.
It's very late now. They've kind of done their mating, and he's probably on his way back to Africa already.
He could be gone, yeah.
It's funny. Not a thing that I like to really think about are summer visitors heading on again. And it's hard when the weather's so warm and sunny to think that, you know, the summer is cracking on. It really is. Now, in the garden, there's plenty to be doing. How's your garden?
I'm just watering. I did plant more spinach, but I was literally just planting in kind of a... like just a crack in the ground, watered it and planted in it, and planted some more radishes as well. But like a lot of things just bolted so quickly. I have fabulous flowers on some of the lettuce and stuff, really nice. And the rocket produces a really nice flower that the bees seem to really like.
Oh, the bees love it. The bees love all the brassica flowers.
Yeah.
So if you're not in a hurry to take it up and you've nothing else to go into the space, just leave it.
Yeah. Well, you can't dig. Like it's impossible to, it's really weird. You kind of go out in the garden to do some gardening and it's actually hard to know what to do. Like, you don't have the same kind of ferocious weeds. I've had no trouble with buttercups this summer, actually, for a change. But it is a difficult year, actually. Very unproductive, really. Carrots that are like maybe, you know, 2 inches high after like 6 weeks and an awful lot of care and watering.
On a commercial level, the vegetable producers are suffering as well.
Oh, so they must be.
I heard a carrot farmer, actually, it's funny you should mention that, but I heard a carrot farmer talking recently, and 2/3 of the crop is already pretty much gone, and he's worried about the third that's remaining. And when you consider the prices that they get for the veg so low in the supermarkets, you'd wonder, you know, I'd say a few of them will be really, pinned against the collar this year. But a tough year to kind of start out in the garden, but don't become disillusioned. Like, it is an exceptional year, and the amount of watering that needs to be done this year is phenomenal. But if it is your first year growing and you haven't had great success, they won't all be like this.
No. Flowers are good though. I have some really good flowers actually. They've come on really well and nice display now.
So that's you planted up a cut flower.
A little cut flower patch. Yeah,
and
I did.
What are the successes in that now?
Borage, Cosmos, sunflowers are not flowering yet, but they're all just about ready. Head has gone blank.
Just corn on the flowers. Sunflowers, while you mentioned those,
yeah.
The best success I've had with those over the last couple of years is growing them in situ. So I always grew sunflowers in the greenhouse and then planted them out. But they become very, very leggy in the greenhouse. They love the heat and they bolt up to a great height.
Yeah.
And then when I was planting them out, I was struggling to tie them onto canes, top and bottom and middle. And if there was a wind came along, the stem was very weak and they would break. Last year and this year, I've just sown them in situ in the garden. They're very, very late to kind of come on. But as they grow, they're self-supporting. So I'm not worrying about them falling
over. And have you got great big stalks? Like
great big massive fat stalks from
so
the ones
that
are grown out in the garden. When you grow them in the greenhouse, they tend to be kind of thin until they kind of catch up. And when you put them in the ground, they lose 2 weeks just feeling sorry for themselves and getting all wilty and so on.
Yeah.
So I think in future, I'm just going to grow more of the seeds, but directly in the garden outside and go for a later display. Much easier.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to them actually flowering now, though.
Yeah, and the birds love it. Once they go to seed, the birds absolutely love it.
Yes, just keep enough for next year.
Exactly, yeah. And then leave the rest for them. So cornflowers as well, you had good success.
Cornflowers and another flower that I just can't think the name of. Calendula or something, kind of a nice orangey yellow flower.
Calendula.
And stuff. Yeah, that's flowering. Yeah. And I actually have poppies for the very first time that have actually planted and successfully flowered. Poppies.
Right, well, if you let them go to seed,
California.
Never again will you be without
Californian
poppies.
That's what I'm hoping.
They are prolific.
They're a beautiful little orangey, kind of light orangey colour. I'm really excited about these, actually.
Excellent. Well, they're a beautiful flower, but I put in some opium poppies, lovely purple opium poppies a few years ago, and now they are absolutely everywhere. They're up and down the drive, they're in the vegetable garden. I don't know how the seed is getting around the place. Tiny, tiny little seed, not borne by the wind. I don't know how it's getting around. But they're all over the place. Now, a few jobs for people to be doing in the garden. It's timely now for you to be pruning the wisteria. It's in second flower out at Crowan. So I've loads of flowers on the wisteria again for some reason. But it's time to remove the kind of whippy side shoots and to tie it up and put a bit of structure on it. And that's one of the jobs that I've done. I've got them growing over the arch in the wall garden out at Crowan Cottages. And they look absolutely lovely at the moment. Lupins, do you have any lupins?
Yes.
Lovely flower. Now it's time to kind of to prune them to encourage more flowers. So you'll get a second flush of flowers.
These are ones
on
I grew from seed, actually, so I'm quite pleased with them.
Lovely shaped leaves. I love the shape of the leaves.
Yeah,
they're really, really...
When you get little drops of water on them, they look amazing.
They're gorgeous, gorgeous, hanging off those kind of spikes of leaves that grow from each one. I really love those. So give them a prune to encourage further flowers. Deadheading, are you doing any of your deadheading?
I was deadheading the roses, but I actually think the roses are suffering without water.
Yeah,
I have a lovely climbing rose over the door of the kitchen, and the flowers seem to have, they kind of came to a point, they flowered well early on, and then the next lot came to a point and then just kind of dried up.
The same thing, the early flush of early flowers and like very little since. But if you do have flowers, pick them off. If you don't, if you're not saving them for the hips, pick them off, and that'll encourage more flowers to develop. Similarly with your sweet peas, deadhead them to encourage more flowers to come out. And your dahlias, make sure to take any of the flowers off the dahlia as well once they've passed it. And
I'm just waiting for my first dahlia to flower. It's imminent.
Okay, I've already had a few, but way behind this year, as with so many other things. Now, one other job before we go to a bit of music. If you want your own potatoes for Christmas, now is the time to plant them in pots or in bags in the greenhouse or plant them outside, but somewhere that you can bring them in after the frosts kind of come about. I'll be doing that this week, and then I'll have my own bags or pots of spuds for Christmas. So now is the time to do that. You have a couple of weeks, but it would be good to get started on that. And if your garlic is gone all yellow and rust-like, don't worry, it's not a disease. It's just telling you that it's finished. All of the goodness has gone down into the bulb, and it's time to harvest your garlic. Leave it on the ground to dry. Try not to damage the basal plate. Leave the roots on it, and then once it's dried, you can tie it up and store it over winter. Right, plenty more jobs to look at next week, but we're going to leave you now with a little piece of music. I thought this song was very, very appropriate. It's by a guy called Jack Leatherman in the US, and it's a song called Invasive Species. We'll be back we'll be back next week live from Friday from 4 to 5. During the week, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at NesbittF or at Mags Morrissey, or you can email the show kitchengarden@ckc.ie. The show will be repeated on Monday between 4 and 5, or you can listen to a podcast of this or any of the other shows by visiting kitchengarden.ie. We'll be back on Community Radio Kilkenny City, same time next week.
Into this world naked, chewing up the scenery, crowding out every native that can adapt to me. Survival of the fittest, blood muck of Cain. You can't eradicate me, 'cause I'm the top of the food chain, baby. Species, yeah. Some people call me exotic, others call me a pest. People call me the master of the dispossessed. I'm like a Burmese python, caught around your chest. You better learn to love me, 'cause I'm a permanent guest now, baby. Terrestrial or aquatic, domesticated or wild, will never be symbiotic, an illegitimate child. You can try to uproot me, try to burn me out, mutilate or pollute me, my poison seed will still sprout up, baby.